Good morning. I'm Anthony Gulino, ICE Technical Coordinator. Welcome to the ICE 2020 Virtual Annual Conference. This is our DMHC session with Mary Watanabe. I would now like to introduce today's moderator, Mike Myers, ICE Board President and Director of Agency Relations.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining today's session. It's my pleasure to introduce this morning Mary Watanabe, of the California Department of Managed Healthcare, the state entity that oversees health plans that provide healthcare services to more than 26 million Californians. As acting director, Mary is responsible for protecting consumers' healthcare rights and ensuring a stable healthcare system in accordance with federal and state rules. It's our pleasure to have Mary here this morning, and we'll turn it over to you, Mary. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be with all of you again this year, even if we are virtual. I was thinking this morning that I think the last three years I've had a different title every time I presented, but it's an honor and a privilege to be here with you as the acting director this time. As I've always done, I'm going to provide a leadership and organizational update. I am going to talk a little bit about our response to COVID-19, as well as talk about some of the recent legislation that was signed and talk about the regulations that are in the queue. And give you a preview of where we think we're headed next year in terms of the priorities for the department. I always like to start with our mission statement. If you're not familiar with us, as Mike said, we are the regulator, and our mission is to protect consumers' healthcare rights and ensure a stable healthcare delivery system. I think last year our org chart looked very similar. You'll see that I am currently both the acting director and chief deputy director. We continue to have several deputies functioning in acting positions, including Sarah Rehm, our acting general counsel. We did fill two new deputy positions, actually three this year. Nicole Eshelman is our deputy director for the Office of Administrative Services. Sonia Fernandez, formerly of our Office of Plan Monitoring, is now our deputy director for the Office of Enforcement. And I'm very excited to announce that Amanda Levy just joined us at the beginning of last month as our Health Policy and Stakeholder Relations Deputy Director, which was, many of you know, was my former position. Amanda comes to us with 16 years of experience at the California Psychological Association, and she's already jumped in feet first to lead some of our legislation implementation activities, and look forward to having you meet her in future years. This is our infographic from our 2019 annual report, but I think it's a really good summary of some of the department's activities and who we are as a regulator. We regulate and license 125 health plans. This includes 80 full service and 45 specialized plans, which include dental, vision, and behavioral health plans. I will note that we have on the slide that we regulate and I have oversight and consumer protection responsibility for 26.4 million consumers. We recently updated that. We're over 27 million consumers now. So take that responsibility very seriously. We also regulate about 96% of commercial and public health plan enrollment in the state. This slide kind of gives you an image of where we've come from and how we've grown over, particularly over the last 6 years, 7 years here. Our current budget for 2019 and 20 was $91 million with 482 positions. And for this fiscal year in 21-22, we are up to $96 million budget and 505 authorized positions. This slide shows our enrollment over time. Again, we're at about 27 million. About half of that, about 12.7 million, is in government lives, which includes Medi-Cal and Medicare. We're actually about 13.5 million on the commercial side. So we've seen some growth there. And now I'll just talk about our response to COVID-19. I think it's obviously top of mind for all of us, particularly right now, but it's been kind of the unexpected issue we've all been dealing with this year. We responded very quickly in early March by issuing our first all plan letter related to COVID. We've issued 20 all plan letters since March 5th. And I'll highlight just a few. I would encourage you, we did set up a COVID-19 webpage. So if you go to our public website at healthhelp.ca.gov, On the right side, there's a link to our COVID-19 webpage, as well as the Department of Public Health's website. We have linked kind of our response to COVID and our all-plan letters that are relevant there. I think some of the more important ones that you may be interested in is our one of the earlier ones we issued in March was related to telehealth, really to make sure that plans were continuing to provide medically necessary healthcare services via telehealth and that there were not any barriers to that, and that there was reimbursement as if those services were delivered in person. We've since issued some follow-up guidance related to that around billing, and to reiterate that that guidance is in place as long as we have a state of emergency. We also partnered with the Surgeon General and our Department of Aging and our Department of Public Health to issue a couple of different reminders and guidance related to making sure our most vulnerable populations were contacted, that we were making sure they were safe, that they had the resources they needed. So that also came very early in the pandemic. We've also done some extensions of planned deadlines. Obviously, as we were all scrambling to telework back in March and April, there was an impact both to plans and to providers. And so we provided some guidance on the extension of those deadlines. We also worked closely with Covered California. They did a number of extensions of special enrollment periods. We did a number of extensions off exchange, really to make sure that those that may have lost coverage as a result of businesses shutting down, changes in income, that they had an opportunity to sign up for health insurance. The most notable one that I think many of you are very familiar with is we issued an emergency regulation. This was back in July. Related to the health plan's obligation around testing. And I'm going to talk about that in a little more detail in a minute. But this was really to make sure that those with, particularly with commercial health insurance and also with Medi-Cal coverage, were able to get testing and some guidance that we issued there. We also have done a number of fact sheets related to coverage options and COVID-19 testing, which are, again, available on that webpage that we set up. Let's see. Okay, so our emergency regulation took effect on July 17th. We promulgated this regulation really to provide clarity and certainty to enrollees, plans, and providers regarding when plans must cover COVID-19 testing. The plain language of the Federal CARES Act and the Family First Act said that plans have to cover COVID-19 testing with no cost sharing, no utilization management, and it regardless of whether the enrollee receives the test from an in-network or out-of-network provider. And this was really tied to some of the earlier guidance that we issued. However, there was subsequent federal regulatory guidance that narrowed the scope of the federal laws by requiring coverage only when an enrollee has symptoms of COVID or known or suspected exposure. So our regulation outlined the circumstances when plans must cover testing, and it clarified when cost sharing is allowed and specified that plans may not pass on the cost of testing to their delegated providers unless the providers have agreed to specifically absorb the costs. I think the easiest way to wrap your head around our emergency regulation really is just to talk about the three buckets, but I do want to point out, because this was an emergency regulation, it remains in effect until May 14th of 2021. And there were some extensions about how long emergency regulations are in place that impacted that time frame. So in terms of the three buckets, the first bucket here category is a person with symptoms or exposure to COVID-19, and a plan has to cover testing at zero cost sharing. And this is really the category that the per federal law, If someone has symptoms or known exposure, they can go anywhere and the plans need to cover the test. The next category is for enrollees that are asymptomatic essential workers with no recent known or suspected exposure. The regulation defines who is an essential worker, but it includes categories like healthcare workers, retail sector employees, food and grocery workers, teachers, and our correctional and safety officers. Under the federal guidance, a plan wouldn't have to cover testing for these essential workers if they don't have symptoms or known exposure. So our regulation provides clarity that plans must provide a testing appointment within 48 hours, and asymptomatic workers must try to get a test from an in-network provider, but if the plan doesn't provide an appointment within 48 hours, the worker can go out of network, which this mirrors our existing requirements. The third category of enrollees consists of those who aren't essential workers, but who are asymptomatic and don't have known or suspected exposure. This could include someone who wants to get a test, as we know many, many people did recently, who want to travel, or those maybe who are having a medical procedure and their provider wants them to get tested beforehand. In this case, the plan must provide a testing appointment within 96 hours. And may use the normal utilization management criteria to determine if the test is medically necessary. And for those in category two or three, the plans may impose ordinary cost sharing. All right, so that was our only emergency regulation, our regulation that took effect recently. We have a lot of regulations in the queue. I think the total count is probably close to 13. But these regulations that you see here on the slide are the ones that we anticipate probably being released in 2021. The first regulation is our timely access to care, which I think I've been talking to you all about this for several years now. The regulations provides a standard methodology for how plans measure and report timely access to care requirements. The goal of the regulation is to ensure plans collect and provide meaningful data to the DMHC so that the public can assess whether plans networks are able to meet the timely access standards. We've had one comment period so far, and it closed on July 27th. We received a significant amount of feedback, which we are reviewing and anticipate having our second comment period with the changes incorporated into the regulation. We anticipate releasing that hopefully by the end of this year. The next one is related to SB 855. I'll talk a little bit more about this bill in our legislation update. This was enacted this year and takes effect January 1st. It's intended to ensure plans cover behavioral health conditions in parity with medical conditions. Before this bill, plans had to cover or services to treat serious emotional disturbances of a child and 9 enumerated severe mental illnesses. SB 855 expands coverage to all mental health and substance use disorders. It also specifies and defines medical necessity in the context of mental health and substance use disorder treatment. And there's also limits on the types of UM criteria that plans may use when determining medical necessity. We are doing a lot of work with stakeholders right now on the implementation of the pieces that take effect on January 1st. But we're also working to develop regulations to clarify various provisions in SB 855. This is one that we anticipate having something to share probably in the first quarter of next year. Provider directories, another one that I think I've been talking to you all about for about 5 years. Senate Bill SB 137, and it was enacted in 2015, and it required us to establish provider directory standards. It allowed us to create and apply standards through 2020, through this year, without having to go through the formal rulemaking process. So we're now in a position where we are ready to release a regulation. For the most part, the regulation is codifying the existing standards that we had. With some changes, we've been working very closely with our plans and providers, working closely also with IHA on the Symphony provider directory initiative to make sure that we have good information on what worked and what was challenging with those standards. And so I think for the most part you will see a codification of what we already did. This is another one that we're targeting the first quarter of next year to release. We also have a Help Center cleanup regulation, which mostly makes non-substantive changes to some of our Help Center forms and notices. However, there are a few changes we're making to what it means for the Medi-Cal grievance process to be presented for a fair hearing. There's also some pieces related to our independent medical review process that we'll be clarifying. The out-of-pocket maximum tracking is one that we have been working on for quite some time. I think the ability to track this information has continued to evolve as technology changes, but we are hoping to have a regulation before the end of next year, really to better understand, to help enrollees understand where they are in meeting their out-of-pocket maximum tracking. And then finally, the other one in the queue for next year is our prescription drug tiering. Current law prohibits health plans from having more than four cost tiers in their formulary. Assembly Bill 339 from 2015 prohibits plans from placing drugs into tiers in a way that discourages enrollment by people with chronic conditions. We have been examining formularies. We've hired a consultant to help us with this work, but we're hoping to have a regulation to address tiering next year. All right, moving on to legislation. It ended up being a little bit of a quieter legislative session, mostly because of COVID and all of the response that was happening. But we do have several bills that we are tracking and will be issuing guidance around implementation. The first is AB 80. This is a budget trailer bill which revised the permitted range for the actuarial value of specified non-grandfathered bronze level health plans. This is an issue that was coming up for the last few years. It also provides the DMHC with authority to take enforcement if health plans are not in compliance with submitting information to the Office of Statewide Health Planning Development's Healthcare Payments Data Program. So we're looking forward to working with OSHFED on that program. The next one is AB 1124. This bill authorizes us to approve 2 4-year pilot programs that would permit risk-bearing organizations and restricted health plans to undertake arrangements with either a qualifying, what we call voluntary employees beneficiary association, or a VEBA, or a qualifying trust fund. These arrangements are not subject to the full requirements of the Knox-Keene Act. But the VEBA or trust fund and participating entity would have to annually report information to the DMHC, and then we would include information in a report to the legislature. These arrangements I mentioned are not subject to the full requirements of the Knox-Keene Act, but there are specific categories of Knox-Keene consumer protections which will apply and that will have to be reported to the department. The key dates here is, again, by May 1st, we have to approve these pilots. So we're working on our template for the application. The pilot will run from January of 2022 through December of 2025. And again, we will report to the legislature on the findings of whether these worked and the benefits or non-benefits of these programs to the legislature by January of 2027. The next one is AB 2118. This bill requires health plans and health insurers to annually report rate information on premiums, cost sharing, benefits, enrollment, and trend factors in the individual and small group market. This really mirrors, for the most part, the filing that has been in place for the large group market. And then starting in 2022, it requires the DMHC to annually present publicly this information. The next one, AB 2157, makes some technical changes to our independent dispute resolution process. We have had this process in place for several years, and there have been some concerns about the confidentiality of the evidence and potentially the contract information that's submitted as part of this review. For the most part, this is codified, or it's consistent with some of the recent changes we've made to the process to make sure that both plan and provider information that submitted for the IDRP is kept confidential. And then we have SB 406. This was a healthcare omnibus bill which preserves the existing ban on lifetime and annual limits on healthcare benefits and the existing requirement that health plans cover preventative services without cost sharing by making these requirements independent of federal law. It also extended the funding and the sunset date of CHBRP, the California Health Benefit Review Program, by 2 years. And then the big one, as I already talked a little bit about this, SB 855. Every year, I think we have a bill that's signed by the governor that really has the biggest impact to the department, and this is it. It also has a big impact to plans and hopefully makes some really important improvements for consumers. It takes effect, as I mentioned, January 1st. It amends our California's mental health parity statute and requires commercial health plan insurers in the group and individual market to cover treatment for all medically necessary mental health and substance use disorder conditions as listed in the most recent version of the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders. As I mentioned, it defines medically necessary treatment. It also requires plans to arrange for coverage for medically necessary out-of-network mental health and substance use disorder treatment services when in-network options are not available. And I think this is a really important protection. It's not just for plans to require to cover out-of-network coverage if they can't provide it in-network, but to help consumers navigate and arrange for those services. It also sets criteria for clinical guidelines when making medical necessity and level of care decisions. And it requires plans to establish procedures that are to ensure compliant utilization review processes. And I will say this is probably the area where we will be doing the most work quickly and are currently working with both our stakeholders and the plans to implement. And finally, before I take some questions from all of you, I wanted to take a moment to talk about our priorities. Obviously, we're hoping to have our leadership team solidified soon and have less acting as we head into the next year. But a couple of the things that are top of mind and a focus for me and for our leadership team. The first four here really are in many ways in response to COVID-19. Behavioral health is, as you know, has been a top priority for the administration, but also for the department. We have done a significant amount of work on compliance around mental health parity, both state and federal mental health parity. And I think the overarching message that we all hear from consumers is it's still just too hard to get the care that they need. There are many barriers to accessing care, and so we received funding to conduct 5 behavioral health investigations a year to really understand where those barriers are for consumers throughout the various touch points of the healthcare delivery system to understand where the challenges are to inform potential regulatory or statutory changes, but also just to ensure that the plans are complying with the law. There's a lot of other work happening just to think creatively about how we make improvements to the behavioral health system. So it is definitely a priority of ours. The other two I'm going to put in the bucket of access and network adequacy. I think one of the things many of us are thinking about is how do we ensure that we have an adequate network of providers when we come out of COVID-19? There are a lot of exciting changes that have happened as a result of COVID and with telehealth and the expansion of telehealth. And how do we look at telehealth in terms of network adequacy and timely access? And so I think there's some opportunities for us to think creatively and differently about how we look at timely access and network adequacy with that component of telehealth. I think there's a lot of questions about what consumers want and making sure that consumers have the option to go in person if that's what they need or want. But also how do we really support the expansion of telehealth in a post-COVID world? So both of those are going to be very important for us. Health equity, hopefully this is something all of your organizations are thinking about. I think the events of the last year, the systemic racial injustice, the impact on health, the impact of the disproportionate impact of COVID on our communities of color. We are thinking about how we apply a health equity lens to everything that we do, whether that's our having a culturally and linguistically appropriate workforce. How do we make sure we're monitoring to make sure those that need interpreter services can get it? And a lot of other areas that I think that we've got a lot of work to do on the health equity front. And I think that will continue to be a priority as we head into the next year. Provider directories and encounter data are two that I think we've talked about quite a bit at this forum before. Again, we are working closely with IHA on the Symphony Provider Directory effort. Both the Provider Directory and Encounter Data initiatives were funded by undertakings that we required as a result of health plan mergers. So that work continues, and we will continue to be very supportive of that work. Encounter data, I think we've talked a little bit about this before. HealthNet has had a number of work groups and held a summit in the fall or late summer to really inform how we address the industry challenge of improving encounter data. They're currently working on selecting a governing entity that will lead the effort to really try to tackle this industry challenge of accurate and complete and timely encounter data. And with that, I will stop talking and see if we have any questions.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mary. And we do have some questions in here. If anyone else has a question, please enter your question into the question box and we will ask it for you. And if you could also include your organization, that would be helpful. We have your name, but it would be nice to know which organization you represent. So our first question is from Brittany Friend with ZyMed Medical Group. And the question is it possible for the DMHC to extend the emergency regulation from May 14th, 2021 to a later date?
Yeah, no, it is. And we would need to go through the formal rulemaking process. And so it's something that we will continue to monitor. We would basically need to turn it into more of a permanent regulation. And there is a little bit of a lengthier process associated with that. I think many of you know that our emergency regulation, I think we filed it and it was approved within a number of days. So that was a very short turnaround, but it is something we are considering if there's a need to do that beyond May.
Okay, great. Next question is from Mary London of Mary London Consulting. Can you explain the difference in RKK and regular KK licensure, especially why APAs would want to get RKK instead of just being delegated? What is the advantage for the IPA and or patients? And are applications up or down this COVID year?
Oh, no, good question. I will tell you, I am probably far from the expert in the weeds on the advantages and disadvantages of one over the other. With our restricted license, they're contracting and taking enrollment from a fully licensed plan. They don't market or do the direct enrollment themselves. I think there are a number of advantages and disadvantages of the different license types, and I'd be happy if you want to follow up with me. I'd be happy to connect you with someone in our office that could explain that to you and give you more information about that process. In terms of whether licenses are up or down, we are continuing to get license applications. I will say that the bulk of our applications right now seem to be in Medicare Advantage, so that seems to be the growth area right now. And I don't know that we've necessarily seen a drop off in those. I know many of those are restricted licenses or are KK licenses.
Okay, thank you. Next question is from Shar Dixon of UCSD Medical Group. Does the emergency regulations apply to all HMO plans, commercial, Medicare Advantage, and Medi-Cal?
Yeah, so it applies to the plans that we regulate. So that would be probably the bulk of the HMOs. So we obviously don't regulate the self-funded plans or anything that is at the Department of Insurance. It also does not apply to Medicare. We have financial oversight for Medicare, but not in terms of some of the consumer protections and the other pieces. So there's federal laws that apply for Medicare. And then Medi-Cal, we have different requirements the Department of Healthcare Services has issued for Medi-Cal.
Okay, and the next question is from Bob O'Reilly from Q-Metrics. What will be expected of plans for SB 855 prior to the regulations, since the effective date is January 1st, but regulations will not be out yet?
Hi, it's good to hear from you, Bob. So good question. We are working very closely with the plans and the associations right now to get out guidance on that. Certainly appreciate the challenges with implementing a regulation. We always have this issue where we've got 3 months from the time we have things that are signed and the implementation date. I will tell you the most important piece for me as the acting director is to make sure that consumers, if they file a grievance, that they are protected and that these new requirements are applied. We understand that there will be time needed for plans to implement some of the system changes to file policies and procedures and things with the department. So we're working on that. We're hoping to get guidance out here in the next couple of weeks, but I appreciate the challenge of just this is a big lift. To get in place by January 1st. But again, that the important piece for us is how you are taking care of consumers starting January 1st so that they receive the benefits of this new law.
Great. Next question is from Sean Paul of Cedar Sinai. And Sean says, this is a bit more granular ask. Misdirected claims inhibit resources between MCOs and their delegated groups. Is there any opportunity to consider legislation to have the onus of misdirected claims redirected to the initiator rather than hold the MCOs and groups accountable? Again, this adds to resource and cost constraints for an item we're not necessarily responsible for the cause.
Yeah, no, that's actually an interesting question. A couple of things. One, I would say if there's an opportunity to, you want to talk to the department about any of these issues, we're happy to set up a meeting to hear more about those issues. In terms of legislation, I can't, you know, speak for where we would be on legislation if it were proposed. We'd have to take a look at that at that time. I certainly appreciate the challenges that places on you, and I'd be happy if you want to follow up with me, you're welcome to, and we can schedule a call with my team to see if there's something within our existing authority that we might be able to do.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Mary. We really appreciate you participating. Great job as always, and thank you all for the questions today and the follow-up. Please reach out to Mary if you have any additional or detailed questions. And again, thank you for joining our session this morning.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.